I totally went broke. I went from $15 million to literally $143 in the bank. And I was so depressed. I wanted to kill myself, basically.
I'm here today with James Altucher. You're a Renaissance man, entrepreneur, novelist, chess grandmaster back in the day.
After years of writing and not getting published anywhere, I suddenly was able to get paid for writing. I had gotten my idea muscle exercised, and I wrote 10 ideas a day for this guy. And a lot of people don't like to share ideas. They're like, oh no, they'll steal my idea. Let them steal your idea. Because again, how many ideas are you going to work on? It's much better if many of the ideas you're not even remotely considering working on are actually in the world. And people might not admit it, but they know deep down where those ideas came from, and that will always lead to more opportunities.
I was watching your TED Talk last night, Skip the Line, and you just like nonchalantly said, oh, in Monopoly, only buy orange properties. You left an open loop.
You're listening to the Real Business Connections Network.
Real Business Connections Network.
Powered by Balbert Marketing, LLC. Subscribe now and check us out at realbusinessconnections.com. Enjoy the show.
Welcome, everyone, once again to Learn, Speak, Teach on the Real Business Connections Network. I'm here today with James Altucher. James, what's happening, brother?
Thanks so much, Ben. Thanks for having me on the podcast. Glad to be here.
Yeah, listen, man, I think I first heard of you and your podcast. It had to have been like 8 years ago, like 2015, 2016.
I started this just about 10 years ago. Like, you know how you have to have a bunch of episodes in the can before you launch a podcast? You have to have like 3 or 4 episodes. I did my first episode around June of 2013. So 10 years ago.
So a lot of people like me in the podcasting space already know you, but I'm going to give a quick, I tried to take everything in your life and squeeze it into one bio. I hope we do it justice to help the listener. But you're truly a Renaissance man, entrepreneur, novelist, chess grandmaster back in the day, hedge fund manager, comedian, reality late night show host, expert finance TV personality, podcast host, blogger, public speaker. I think you've spent more money on Airbnbs than anyone I've ever met. And all of this is really just a testament of your unique journey, which you've documented in multiple best-selling books. And your show that we just kind of mentioned, the James Altucher Show. I missed a lot too, right? What did I miss? What comes to mind that I missed? Well, and by the way, I want to give you the award, the Renaissance Man Award. But what did I miss?
Well, you know, the problem with, like, it could be a jack of all trades, master of none. So for instance, you know, for 6 years, I kind of gave up everything else in my life and did stand-up comedy. So I was working on stand-up comedy every day. I was performing 6 nights a week. Like, I built up to that because I couldn't get on stages at first, but then you get better and better and you start getting booked on stages. And I got good enough to travel around, tour around, and even perform in other countries, but I never got like great. And I feel like that's the way with most of the things I do. So you know, I get excited about something. I work really hard at it. It's like I go on a quest and like everything is motivated. Everything I do is motivated by that quest. And then at some point, the quest is just over and I start something new.
Well let's talk about it, because a term like jack of all trades, master of none is a bit negative. And let's be realistic. Do you have to be a master at any of these things to still go on the quest and be successful at it?
That's a really good question. And the answer is definitely no, because the quest itself, and I hate that phrase, it's all about the journey, not the goal, because it is about the goal. You wouldn't have a journey if you didn't have a goal. Like, I wanted to really be good at stand-up. I wanted to improve and be as best as I could be at stand-up comedy. So that created the journey. That showed me the direction I should go and what I needed to do. And I learned a lot about learning because of all the different things I've done. I've had to like say, okay, now I'm going on this path of learning and this is what I do when I learn. But at the same time, you know, when you go, like when King Arthur didn't find the Holy Grail, he was disappointed. I mean, I don't really know all of King Arthur literature, but I'm assuming he got disappointed when he failed at his mission. So sometimes I wish I could be really interested in something like bird watching. And I'm not making fun of bird watching. This is all credit to bird watchers. But with bird watching, you maybe do it with your significant other, like your wife or whatever, and you go out into nature and you bring a book and like, oh, there's a fancy blue jay or whatever, and you write it down and then you have a good day. And it's hard. It seems to me, I'm probably wrong, but it seems to me it's probably hard to have a bad day. But when you, you know, I've been a day trader, I've been an entrepreneur, I'm a writer, you know, you mentioned all these other things like chess, comedy, podcasting. Sometimes I have really bad days because of this, because the journey wasn't working out today. And that's frustrating. That's hard.
It's interesting what you said about bird watching. It reminds me of Forrest Gump. I just felt like running. There is a beauty in just not even having to be on a quest, just doing things to do it out of enjoyment. But I think you're a little bit like me, where I'm a little bit neurotic and I like to try new things and this and that and dabble with different things. Well, what kind of quests, like what new things that maybe weren't in that intro, what's new that you've been working on?
Well, you know, you mentioned that, you know, so back in 1997, when I was younger, when I was like 17, 18, I fell in love with chess as an example. And a few years later, I became a chess master, like in playing in tournaments and so on. And more recently, I wanted to prove that just because I'm 25 years older than that moment, I can still get as good as or even better than I used to be at chess. So I started playing in tournaments again, and I did everything I normally do when I start learning something. I got a coach to teach me. I started giving lessons, because if you can explain something simply, it's a way to demonstrate that you truly understand something. And I, you know, found my cohort of equals that I could exchange notes with and learn from. And I started playing in tournaments again, and it's really hard. And some people have even told me that they think I'm totally delusional, that I could get as good as I was when I was, you know, in my 20s, now that I'm in my 50s. And it's really hard. And that's what I've been working on, is this quest. And the idea is, and Robert Greene, who wrote 48 Laws of Power and Mastery and a bunch of other really great books, he said to me, boy, you have to write a book about this, show that this sort of thing is possible. And so I've been really committed to like writing this book. But I to your point, earlier question about, do you need to achieve the goal? Like, I feel like I need to achieve the goal to have an interesting book here. And it's really hard. I don't even know why it's so hard.
What happens if you don't achieve it?
I don't know. I think I just keep going until I achieve it, or until I lose interest, which is typically the way I do things, is that I keep going until I achieve some goal or until I find something else to pursue. And I'm trying to think, though, if I have a book without achieving it. Like, you know, there's this concept of, like, for instance, I call this a quest. And a quest is not just about playing, you know, a game that maybe most people view as a boring sort of pursuit. You know, chess, you sit there for hours looking at an 8x8 board, and, you know, you play in these tournaments and so on. But I've traveled all around the world. I've had dinner with the world chess champion in Norway. I've had, anyway, all sorts of adventures on this process, plus the whole concept of researching cognitive decline as we age. Like, this quest has given me better habits, better sleep schedule, more exercise, better diet, because all of these things are needed to, you know, I didn't necessarily need them when I was trying to be a peak performer in my 20s, but now I need them. Like, I can't be a peak performer without improving my health as well, and even my emotional health. And so the concept of a quest is interesting no matter what, but I do feel that I need to achieve this goal in order to really capture the imagination of the audience. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. A lot of people have asked me, like, maybe you don't need to achieve this goal, but I feel like I should achieve it.
Hey, I'm rooting for you.
Me too.
I've got two questions. They're kind of the same question, but it's why chess? And it's, why did you get started with chess in the first place? What draw you to that specific activity? And then the current why chess? Out of all things to go back and try again, why was chess your decision?
Yeah, I mean, the second answer is the second question is really, I guess in both cases, it's a really kind of an emotional thing. So when I was in high school, I wasn't a good looking person. I wasn't a jock. I didn't really have much going for me. And I suddenly realized, oh, I'm pretty good at this one thing. And it's a way for me to feel good about myself and to maybe escape a feeling of escape during kind of the negative aspects of being a teenager in a high school that you don't enjoy and, you know, not having like a girlfriend or whatever. And so that was then. And now it's almost similar now. Not, you know, now I'm happily married. I've had different kinds of success. And, but I wrote this article a couple of years ago that kind of went viral, meaning millions of people read it.
I wasn't going to bring it up, but if you want to bring it up.
We don't have to bring up like all the details of it. I mean, it was a good article. A lot of people loved it. I mean, more people loved it than hated it. Yeah. But if 20 million people love something and 1% hate it, like with a passion, 1%, that means I'm going to get 200,000 angry emails and articles about me and everybody yelling at me and you know, family hating me and Jerry Seinfeld writing a full page op-ed trashing me and Andrew Cuomo, who was the governor of New York at the time, sending out an email to 10 million people trashing me. And
in a weird way, not to interrupt, in a weird way, what an honor. What an honor to get that kind of attention.
It's true. And I almost wish I had viewed it that way. And I don't really take a lot of things personally, but every now and then, like the bar gets higher and higher to like affect me personally. And most negative criticism I could ignore, particularly I knew like a lot of people loved the article. Like I can go on and on with all the people who supported me, but including the mayor of New York City or Eric Adams, who's currently the mayor of New York City. And the article was about New York City, but somehow this really affected me. Like I had family members who wrote actual articles trashing me and exes who wrote articles trashing me and friends who started to not like me for some reason or because of this article. And it really, I got into a funk. I got like actually depressed. And so, and I felt like I couldn't write. Like for the past almost 25 years before that moment, I wrote every single day without fail, like wow. Never took a break. And I couldn't write anymore. I felt like, oh my gosh, this is like really dangerous to write. Or I don't know what I was thinking. It was like a subconscious thing, but I just couldn't write. So I fell back to my second activity that I enjoy doing, you know, in kind of the mental or creative realm. And then that was chess. Chess has always been the thing. Like, oh, I didn't have, you know, back in 2003, oh, I didn't have a good day trading. Let's work it off. I'll play some chess and get some dopamine and so on. So I fell back to that and I started playing very intensely and very seriously, thinking it was just a phase. But then I decided, you know what? I realized I am not as good as I was 25 years ago. Like I'm missing something. And all these kids or new players, they're doing something that I didn't understand. I the game had changed. In other words, like the way you study the game, the way you play the game, you know, the way you get better at it, all of that had changed. Plus all of the moves and ideas that I was used to, even those had changed. And some of them had been shown to be not so good and so on. So I was like, you know, this is interesting. I'm going to get good. I'm going to get better again. And then it became linked to all I would tell people and they were like, oh, you can't get better at this age. This is a young player's game. You know, your memory is not going to be as good. Your calculation is not going to be as good. You're not going to be able to, your visual spatial intelligence is not going to be as good. So you can't do it. Don't be ridiculous. And so, of course, when someone tells me you can't do something, that's when I have to do it. So I started taking it seriously. Yeah. And, you know, I know you have a business podcast. This is sort of related to business because whenever I do go on these quests, it's led to enormous business opportunities for me. And that's always been very interesting, is the link between this quest aspect and making money and doing a business. But I started, so basically it came out of being depressed and trying to escape the world, at least for a little bit. And then it kind of morphed into proving people wrong about kind of cognitive decline as it relates to this one field. And then I started having these amazing adventures as I started playing again and playing in tournaments. And people started asking me to, oh, hey, can you come to Norway and hang out with the world champion? Can you go to Amsterdam and watch this famous tournament take place? And hey, can you write for the magazine that I used to love as a kid? Now I'm a columnist for them. You know, all these things start to happen and it's exciting. So that was a long answer.
It is exciting. And just so you know, this is like a business podcast, sort of, but it really is the story behind the story. It's the quest behind the success, because all the strategy and tactics are already out there. It's through the storylines that we can extract the wisdom and actually implement something. Hopefully a lot of that's resonating to the listener. And I'm wondering, were you always that way? Someone tells you you're not going to do something, you're like, I'm going to do it, and I'm going to do it all the way through. Well, where'd you get that from? Were you born with it?
No. First off, it has to be something that I love doing. If someone says to me, you can't get good at golf, I'll say, no problem. I don't even want to get good at golf. happy to not get good at golf. So it really has to be something that I'm like passionate about. If I was passionate about comedy and, you know, suddenly in my first few weeks of doing it, I, you know, had the experience many comedians have many times, which is I bombed, the people didn't laugh. I'm like, I'm going to get good at this. This is going to happen. But it has to be something I love doing. And I would say, yeah, ever since I was a kid, I get like obsessive about something to the point of being like annoyingly obsessive. Now I can control the annoying aspect, but when I was like 6 years old, I couldn't. And if you give me like an age, I can tell you like every year I was obsessed, every year or 2 years, sometimes the obsessions would last 2 years, but from the age of six on, I was obsessed, always obsessed with something. There never was a time when I wasn't obsessed. And I'm starting to not like this about myself because it leads to a lot of angst as well.
Angst. I'm gonna pivot slightly, because this has been on my mind. I actually told my girlfriend I want to open with this question, but we dove right in. This was the only question I prepared because I lost sleep over it. I was watching your TED talk last night, Skip the Line, and you just like nonchalantly said, oh, in Monopoly, only buy orange properties, beg, borrow, steal, do whatever you can for the orange properties. If you want to win Monopoly, you need the orange properties. And you left an open loop. Why the orange properties? Can you explain that?
Yeah. So you've played Monopoly, you know the game Monopoly, yeah, obviously. Yeah.
And orange is kind of the top left, right?
Yeah, it's like Tennessee, St. James Place, New York Avenue. What is in the game of Monopoly, what is the square that is most landed on in a game of Monopoly?
Is it jail?
It's jail, because you could land on because of the dice, right? You could just roll and land on the jail. There's another square that says go immediately to jail. So that gives you two squares that can force you to go to jail. And then there's two community chess cards that say go to jail. And so there's four different ways to get to jail. For any other square, there's only the dice. So you're four times as likely to be in jail than to be in any other square. And what is the most common dice roll? It's seven. Seven puts you right in the middle of the orange properties.
1, 6, 4, 3, 2, 5. Okay. Yeah.
So if you own the orange properties and have like a lot of houses and hotels on the orange properties are the properties people are most likely to land on, because they're most likely to be in jail and roll a seven, or, you know, six or eight. Seven actually doesn't land you on an orange property, but six or eight does. And nine. Mm-hmm. And so the properties you're most likely to land on the orange properties. So you should just be able to charge a lot of rent on those and you'll win the game.
So this, first off, that's fascinating. Thank you for explaining it. Again, I lost sleep and I'm like, I got to ask this question. Micro learning. So did you learn that as just an example or any of these examples of different games and quests you went on? Like, did you learn it just by doing it or did someone teach you those things?
Both. It's very important to me when I want to learn something that, you know, yes, you could learn things on your own, but that's very difficult. So I have this theory I call plus minus equal, where the second I want to start learning something, I find a plus who's like a coach who could teach me. I find a minus, like someone I can teach, because that's a great way to learn is to explain things. And I find equals, people who are at my level, who we can all challenge each other and compete and learn together. Now, Monopoly, of course, hasn't been a real passion of mine. So it's not like I've got a coach on Monopoly, but I love games in general. And Monopoly is almost has like a classic status. I like classic kind of games. And this is intersects with another point, which is that after I sold my first business around 1998, a couple of years later, I cashed out. I didn't hold stock, nothing. I totally cashed out. I had millions and millions of dollars. And this is in 2000, 2001. And I totally went broke. I went from $15 million to literally $143 in the bank, of like 6 months later. And again,
$15 million to $143.
Yeah.
And I'm reiterating that in case someone wasn't paying attention. That is a big change.
And I was so depressed because I thought I had won the lottery by selling this business. You know, it was during the internet boom, things were overvalued. And I figured that's it. Like I had been set for life. My kids had been set for life. I was quote unquote safe. And is how I thought about it. But then I was really insecure and I tried to make more. I thought it wasn't enough. I tried to make more. And I didn't really, at that time, didn't know the first thing about investing. I was really just stupid, but I thought I was smart. And I blew it. I like invested poorly and I got anxious to make back what I was losing. And so I invested more and more and more and mortgaged my house and invested more. And I did every stupid thing you could possibly do. So I got really depressed and I couldn't get out of bed and I was losing my house. So the house was for sale and it's losing everything, lost everything. And one point I started this habit of, I went to a cafe and I found these waiter's pads and I love the look and feel of waiter's pads. And I started writing down, like, I need to do something. I have two babies and I need to do something. I need to make a living and support my family. And I started writing down ideas for books I could write. So I had been, like I mentioned, I was writing every single day. And I started writing down ideas for books I could write. And then I started writing every day. I would wake up and I started to get excited. Every day I would start writing 10 ideas a day. And I realized, oh, this is like a muscle that I'm developing. Like there's this idea muscle and I'm not used to this. And I started getting excited again and happy about living again. I wasn't happy about living. I wanted to kill myself basically, but I had these two babies and everything. So every day I was just in so much pain and anguish, filled with regret, filled with fear. But then I started writing these 10 ideas a day and I started getting excited. Like, and it wasn't like these were good ideas. Most of the ideas were really, really bad. I had to exercise this muscle and it takes a long time. Most people, if you don't exercise a muscle for a few weeks, you lose it. Like if you don't walk for a few weeks, if you just like lie in bed and watch TV for a few weeks, you have to get physical therapy to kind of walk properly again. So my idea muscle had atrophied. So I was writing ideas down. And one day I wrote this idea of, oh, I should write a book, How to Beat Your Friends and Family at Every Game in the Universe. And so I started thinking, well, I know with chess what to do. And I know with a bunch of card games. And then I started thinking about Monopoly and I kind of figured it out with Monopoly and Scrabble. If you memorize all the 101 two-letter words, you're pretty much set. And then if you remember the 10 of the Q without U words, you're definitely going to beat all the casual players at Scrabble. And so I was getting excited. I wanted to write this book. So that's how I learned. I didn't write the book. If you write 10 ideas a day, that's 3,650 ideas a year. You're going to do maybe one of them at best. Mm. So I didn't write this book, but I kind of played around with it and, you know, figured out how to win every game in the universe, at least good enough to beat your friends and family. But that led me to another thought, which is that, most people, when they try to get good at something, they try to be the best in the world. But I realized if you're just in the top 1% in the world, that's really, really great. Like if I'm in the top 1% of Scrabble players, I'm going to beat all my friends and family 100% of the time. If I'm in the top 1% of, you know, comedians, that means I'm better than the other, you know, 6 billion people who try to be funny all the time. And, you know, chess is another one. Like, I'm a chess master. Okay. You mentioned grandmaster earlier. I'm not a chess grandmaster. I'm a master. Mm. But that means I'm in the top 1/10 of 1%, or maybe the top 1/100th of 1% of people who know how to play chess in the world. So if there's 600 million people who know how to play chess in the world, okay, I'm in the top 600,000 or 60,000, which is really good.
Yeah.
And so I realized with business too, I don't have to have the best company on the planet to be successful at business. I don't have to be Warren Buffett to be successful at investing. I just have to be in the top 1% and I'll be successful at whatever it is I'm doing. And that was a very important realization for me. And I realized that kind of in it very early on when I was writing these 10 ideas a day, is that the idea doesn't have to be the best. It just has to be, you know, in the top 1%. That means it's going to be a noticeably good idea. So, and that has affected all my ideas on learning and success ever since. So that was a long answer. It's a very complicated answer because I weaved in going broke and this concept of exercising your idea muscle, but it really, and you know, some of the ideas that I've had, but it really led to this important realization that you just got to be in the top 1%. And it's not hard to be in the top 1%. You need a coach, you need a minus, you need equals, you need to divide up a skill into micro skills and put together a training program, how you're going to get better at these micro skills. And then there's a few other things.
So I appreciate the extended answer. You actually, earlier I said, do you have to be a master? And you actually answered that question. So I don't have to be the sensei guru, know-it-all, best in the world. I can just be in the top 1% and make a great living and enjoy what I do being in the top 1%. You kind of breeze through it at the end there. Let's slow down. How do I get to that point where, let's say I'm not good at something or I'm okay at it and I find interest in it. How do I get to a point?
By the way, you have to be interested.
Yeah, so I'm interested. I'm excited. How do I get to the top 3%, which I'd be glad to be in a lot of cases?
Well, you tell me. Like, so you're a musician, right?
Yeah, I'm a bad musician. But yeah, I come from the music industry, but I played drums and guitar, but I was never proficient enough to be on stage and impress people.
Okay, but would you say, and maybe the answer is no, I don't know. I've never heard you play, but would you say you're in the top 1% of all the people who have like studied guitar a tiny bit? Would you say you're in the top 3% of guitar players?
I'd say
so there's probably like 100 million people in the world who have attempted to play guitar at different points. Are you in the top 3 million of those?
No.
When you look at it that way, it's different. I bet you the answer is yes.
Think so?
Well, guitar players who perform, maybe there's 30,000 of those.
Yeah.
Okay. So yeah, you never went from the top 3 million to the top 30,000. But, you know, the top 3 million, if you think about it, not that hard. Huh. What would you do to be in the top 3 million guitar players?
You'd practice 20 minutes to an hour a day for a year, and you're probably just as good as most people.
Well, think about it. If you practice, and by practice, it has to be deliberate practice. You can't just like, you know, you have to know what you're doing. So assume you have a coach once a week for an hour who tells you what you need to practice over the next week. Like if you're playing the piano, the coach will say, or your piano instructor will say, practice the scales, C scale, D scale, E scale, and so on. There's probably similar things for guitar. And then after you get proficient at that, you know, you're like, here's some basic songs. Mary Had a Little Lamb, Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star. We're going to learn how to play those on the guitar. And so you start to learn how to really hold the guitar to make music and so on. And 20 minutes a day, let's say with 20 minutes a day, you improve yourself by just 1%. You improve your skills by 1%. How much do you think you'll improve in a year?
Oh, a ton.
Yeah, because it compounds.
Can I jump in with one stat that you might already know, but I did it the other day and I'm excited about it. So there's 1,450 minutes in a day, which means 1% of your day is actually 14 and a half minutes, 14.5. So 15 minutes a day is actually just a 1% difference in your day. That if you put 15 minutes, that's exactly what 1% is. So 20 minutes is actually well beyond 1% change.
Yeah. So let's say again, with deliberate practice, you practiced 1% of your time a day and you improved your skills 1% a day. Compounded, that's 3,700% in a year. So now I don't really know what that means to be 37 times better at guitar in a year, but you'll certainly be in a year in the top 1% of guitar players. If you just did that, if you did deliberate practice, which means a coach tells you what to do, and a coach after a week, you record yourself or the coach sees you again, coach gives you feedback. Oh, you need to do this a little better. Do this instead this week and so on. You will definitely be in the top 1% in a year. And by the way, I want to mention this concept of micro skills. So let's say someone wants to be good at business, at entrepreneurship. There's no such skill as entrepreneurship. It's really a basket of a bunch of micro skills. Mm-hmm. So to be good as an entrepreneur, you have to be good at sales. You have to be good at negotiating. You have to be good dealing with customers. You have to be good with customer service. You have to be good at hiring. You have to be good at motivating. You have to be good at raising money from investors. You have to be good at, you know, managing up with clients and managing up with down with individuals. You have to be good at product development. You have to be good at, you know, execution if you're a service company, and deadlines and P&L and all that kind of stuff. So there's all these skills you have to be good at to be good at business. And it's the same thing. I'll use piano as an example. I know how to play the piano. So you have to be good, at scales. You have to have a pretty good musical sense. You have to have be good at reading music and then memorizing what you've read. You have to have good finger coordination. Your left hand has to be good as your right hand, and you know, playing and on and on. So with chess or with comedy, stand-up comedy, you have to not only be good at writing a joke, you have to be good at telling a joke. You have to be good at crowd work. You have to be good at reading the crowd. You have to be good at stage work. You have to be good at you know, making voices.
Like having light in your face the whole time.
Yeah, you have to be good at stage fright. You have to be if you watch like Louis C.K. like really top comedians, they get the most laughs when they do voices. So you have to be good at doing voices. There's a lot. Most people think, oh, I'm the funny person. I'd be good at stand-up. No, there's huge numbers of skills. So that was another thing, is that as I'm getting good at something, not only do I do the plus minus equal and the deliberate practice, but I have to think, what are the micro skills that I need to get better at?
Right.
Again, not all of them, because I'm just trying to be in the top 1%. I'm not trying to be the world chess champion is good at all the, he's the best in the world at all the micro skills. But to be a good chess master, which again is probably in the top 0.1%, you have to just figure out which micro skills you really need to be good at to shine. And you know, where are your talents and what are you interested in practicing and so on. Like, you don't have to play classical guitar. You could play, you know, pop music guitar, and you'll be in the top 0.1% of guitar players. And so those are all the things. If you want to learn something, kind of the plus minus equal, the micro skills, and try to improve 1% a day with deliberate practice. That's all you need to do. And make sure you don't have get bad habits. Like, again, don't not do the scales on the piano because you want to start playing your favorite songs. Like, you have to be really disciplined about what your coach tells you to do.
Mm. What are the skills? What am I passionate about? Put in the micro, learn the micro skills, implement slowly over time, compound interest. I'm wondering, because one thing I want to push back and kind of circle back around on is you mentioned, you know, 20 minutes a day, you'll probably be in the top 10, 1% of guitar players. And there's a lot of people playing guitar. So I want to circle back around to writing down 10 ideas a day, because what's going through my head is, do I want to compete with all the other guitar players? If I play didgeridoo or xylophone, or if I played French horn, I could very easily work my way to the top. And possibly, if I do a little bit of market research, we need more French horn players. Why am I competing against the guitar players? Is that part of the purpose of writing down 10 ideas a day?
Absolutely. So for instance, let's say I hypothetically wanted to make money at chess. Well,
yeah,
that's really hard to do. Chess has historically not, you know, there are world champions in our history that have died broke and penniless in mental institutions. Like, it's very hard it's not a field people think, oh, I'm going to get play chess and get rich. But okay, well, here's some, you know, that's just something someone could write 10 ideas a day down on. Well, okay, maybe I could stream content and get good at that, which is a different skill, by the way. Streaming is a form of entertainment, and you have to get good at that skill. What if I stream, you know, my games? Or what if I stream games that the world champion is playing? Or what if I stream instructional games from history and I try to explain them? Or what if I do a podcast and I interview all the top players? Or what if I write a book where I document my experiences trying to get good at chess? Or and then I start giving lectures about how to get good at everything. So now I could be a public speaker and on and on and on. So you could brainstorm. Like, here, I used to do this thing where I would write 10 ideas for other people. So for instance, this is still when I was initially had gone broke, like in 2000, and this was around 2003. Now I wrote 10 ideas for this one writer who wrote about financial investing. I wrote 10 ideas for articles he should write. I sent him the ideas and I said, you don't need to respond to me. I'm not trying to have dinner with you or have a coffee with you or anything like that. Like, if you wrote these articles with your perspective, I would happily read them. And I'm sure many of your other readers would love to read them. And I sent them to him and he wrote back instantly. And he said, these are amazing. These are great. Can I hire you to write them? And you start writing for my website. He had a big financial website with a billion users a year. And so that was after years of writing and not getting published anywhere, I suddenly was able to get paid for writing, like, because I wrote 10 ideas. I had gotten my idea muscle exercised and I wrote 10 ideas a day for this guy and he loved them and hired me. And the same thing, I wrote to another guy who was a hedge fund manager and I said, here's 10 pieces of software. I said, I learned your style. I know what you do. Here's 10 pieces of software I think you and your team would appreciate and integrate into your fund. I don't want anything. I don't want to meet nothing. I'm not asking for anything. But if your team needs me to explain the software, I'm happy to do that. And he wrote me back right away and he asked me to lunch and we got to know each other. And eventually he said, why don't you start your own hedge fund? And he was my first investor for it.
Wow.
And So this concept of writing 10 ideas a day is not just healthy from a self-help perspective of being more creative and so on. I started doing this quite a bit. I wrote to Google. I ended up speaking at Google. I wrote to Amazon. I wrote to Amazon 10 ideas for making your self-publishing division a little better. This is back in like 2012 or 2013. And they said, hey, if you're ever in Seattle, they said, these ideas are great. If you're ever in Seattle, we'd like to show you what we're working on and get your opinion. And I said, well, it just so happens I'm going to be in Seattle next week. I had never been in Seattle in my life, and I had no plans on going to Seattle ever in my life. But they said, oh, yeah, sure, stop by. And so I went out to Seattle, and they gave me the full tour and bought lunch and dinner, and I got to meet a lot of people. And then I self-published a book, Choose Yourself, and they were like, oh, yeah, we'll help you, you know, get the word out. It was the number one book in like all of Amazon. Like for a brief moment, it was selling better than Harry Potter and Freakonomics and all of those, and sold over a million copies. And it was because I wrote them. It all started with writing them 10 ideas. And I've been to LinkedIn, Quora, Airbnb, you mentioned Google, Facebook, all because of sharing ideas. A lot of people don't like to share ideas. They're like, oh no, they'll steal my idea. Let them steal your idea. Nothing could be better for you than lots of people stealing your ideas. Because again, how many ideas are you going to work on? It's much better if many of the ideas you're not even remotely considering working on are actually in the world. And people might not admit it, but they know deep down where those ideas came from. And that will always lead to more opportunities.
More and more opportunity.
Yeah. It's very exciting how it works.
Something's coming. So this is a half-baked question because I've never even thought about it before, but it's coming up. So I remember back on, you know, first off, I'm amazed your come up from being broke to doing it back and doing it better the next time. But you were in a place where like it was dark and depressing and suicidal. And you had mentioned how you started writing these 10 ideas a day, and that helped you gain the momentum to get to where you are today. And I'm thinking with AI and ChatGPT, in a great way, in a lot of cases, they're democratizing creativity. But if someone can just go to ChatGPT and ask for 10 ideas, are they going to be going through the same creative process that they once would? Or is that going to cause issues?
I know your worry, because that's my worry. That's every writer's worry. That's the worry of everybody in every job right now. Is AI going to replace me? And by the way, you can write an AI, just using AI, you can write a book in a few hours. And then a few more hours, you could self-publish it on Amazon. Boom, done. And a lot of people, I'm sure, are doing it.
James, I'm less worried about is AI going to replace me. Am I going to use AI not realizing that I'm actually emotionally beating myself? Because at one point I didn't use the AI and now I'm using it as a crutch and I don't realize that I'm actually turning off juices that used to be flowing. I don't care about them replacing me. I'm just worried that I'll use it and then my creativity will be stunted.
Yeah, the answer is no. Your creativity... In fact, pretend it's like this. View AI as not AI, but as a really, really good, smart personal assistant. And yesterday, maybe you said to your personal assistant, give me 10 questions I should ask James Altucher. Like, read his books for me and give me 10 questions I should ask James Altucher. And then your personal assistant gives you 10 questions. You know what? Give me 10 more questions. And the personal assistant doesn't complain, gives you 10 more questions. And you think to yourself, you know what? This is pretty good. I'm going to ask James some of these questions. Does that mean you're not as good a podcaster? No. In fact, now you have time to really, you could think about those questions and think of ways that, first off, your assistant might have told you things you didn't know. So now you have more ammo to ask James Altucher. And maybe you could think more deeply about how these questions relate to experiences in your own life and might trigger more ideas or questions or things that you really want to ask to help yourself, whereas you might not have been so clear about that before. And now you have more time to research more guests. And you have more time to develop skills as a podcaster. What are skills as a podcaster? Well, it's having a conversation like we're having. It's bringing your own personality instead of just reading off of a list of questions, you know, which many podcasters do. And on and on. There's a whole skill set. Like being, you know, podcasting is a form of another entertainment medium. It's a form of entertainment. So it's a skill, hard skill to get really good at podcasting. So again, the AI is just a personal assistant. Like I had on the other day, Chuck Palahniuk, who he wrote the book Fight Club,
Yep.
Came the movie, and he's written tons of great books. He's a great, great writer, great human being. He also wrote a really good book about writing called Consider This. Anyway, he's been on already 3 or 4 times, but I threw it into ChatGPT. What questions should I ask Chuck and Chuck Palahniuk? And gave me some really good questions that I had never asked him before. And I asked them some of them on the podcast, maybe a little differently than how the AI worded it, but I asked them. But that led to more and deeper and richer conversations. And again, he's already been on 3 or 4 times. I've already talked to him about his background and his process. And but these questions that ChatGPT asked, 1 or 2 of them led to much deeper, richer conversations that we always have these great conversations. And it allowed me to be more creative. So that's really the answer to your question is you will be more creative the more help you get.
I like that. I'm not anti-ChatGPT. The bio I read was me copy-pasting your bio, word vomiting my thoughts, and then asking ChatGPT to write me a 3-sentence bio so I don't have to spend time worrying about the presentation, which most people don't even give 2 craps about, but I do want to introduce my guest, and I can focus more on what am I going to ask James today. So not anti it, but I do see even myself, like when I'm doing social media for clients, I'm just being less creative, James. It's simply put, I'm word vomiting ideas into ChatGPT, and they're doing the writing for me, and my grammar stinks.
Well, you know, if your grammar stinks, who cares, really? Like, that's not that important. Like, life's pretty good if that's your main concern.
Yeah, you know, I don't really have too many concerns. I'm living life like a dream, but I look back at times where a few things I do every morning is I write down a few things I'm grateful for. Like you, I'm writing down ideas, and I do something I learned from my friend Matthew Dix, which is homework for life. And I write down, he does it at the end of the day, I do it in the morning. I write down the one most story-worthy moment from the previous day. And there's certain levels of creativity that I can't just imagine ever outsourcing to ChatGPT. And I find that the more I use the AI, just the lazier I get. So maybe I'm just venting, but I'm concerned that people are going to get lazy and slightly less creative, which possibly you tell me will pay better for the people that can actually distinguish good from bad.
No, I think what will happen is that new unexpected venues of creativity will start to appear. And the AI, you'll realize, you needed that crutch. That crutch wasn't really that important. Okay, you look, instead of now, you know, looking up my bio on Wikipedia, you could look at what ChatGPT tells you, and it could even come up with a few questions. Now you get to really be creative in a new way, which is not just ask the basic questions, but really sort of dive deeper. And that's where you are able to separate yourself out to be in the top 1% of podcasters. And I don't think people will be less creative at all. I think they will be more creative, because now the bar for basic creativity will go down, and it'll unleash like higher creativity. And look, I can take an example from chess. I hate to be always talking about chess, but AI has sort of conquered chess long before ChatGPT. I mean, I actually worked on for a small amount of time, Deep Blue, which was the computer in 1997, the IBM computer that beat it was the first time a computer beat the human world champion, Garry Kasparov. And then people were like, okay, that's it. Chess as a game is over. It's not interesting anymore. Well, guess what? Now fast forward 25, 26 years, and people are taking their ideas, like particularly young people who grew up with this, like they've never had a time when computers and AI weren't better than humans at chess. They get their ideas from, oh, is this move good in this particular opening? Oh, what's that move that the computer is recommending? Oh my God, that's like an unbelievable move. And so the computer will tell them like these unbelievable moves that no human would have ever looked at, but then you still have to play the game and you still have to win and you still have to be creative to win. Like chess requires a lot of creativity to actually win a game. And it's only enhanced the game and made the game much more beautiful. Like the best computers now are just 100 times better than the best human in the world. And he learns from the computer. And that's why he's able to play such beautiful games, is because he's getting the most beautiful ideas from a source that humans would not be able to get those ideas from.
It's a good point. Thanks for going here with me.
No problem.
I don't know what to think half the time.
I don't know either. Like, and I had to think about this too. Like, is this going to be disappointing now? Like, and so I made the attempt at using just AI to write a book, and I did it in an afternoon. I didn't publish it, but I had a topic, which, by the way, is a source of creativity, just coming up with a topic. But my topic was how using neuroscience to help you learn better. And I threw in that prompt into ChatGPT, and it came up with an answer. It came up with, like, you know, a few paragraphs, and then something caught my eye that was interesting. It mentioned some kind of neurochemical, and I was like, well, how do I get that neurochemical? And it said, this neurochemical is found in these, you know, 12 foods. And I said, well, write me 3 recipes using those 12 foods. And it wrote it just like it was formatted in a cookbook, and like, you know, a banana smoothie with goji berries and, you know, a tint of fish oil. I don't know.
Yeah.
All these. And, you know, I was using prompts to, not only was creative on the, I had to use some creativity on the title, and I mean on the topic. Then I had to use some creativity on the prompts I was asking it, just wherever my curiosity took me. And it still made a horrible book. The book still needs to be written well. And humans, the best human writers are always going to be better than the AI, because the one thing that AI can't do is move the frontier of human experience. And humans have to do that, because we're the ones creating that frontier. And the computer can guess what the frontier is, and it'll do a good job of that. But only I can experience what it's like to go up on stage 3,000 times doing mediocre comedy, and then write what that feels like. The AI could pretend to do that, but it can't do that. And doing that might lead me to how I interact with people in a business meeting, or the kind of book I write, or the kind of, you know, humility I have when dealing with people in metaphorically related situations, and on and on. So again, I just think of AI now as a really great assistant. Just like when I'm preparing for a chess tournament, I'm like, okay, I see on the computer my opponent plays these variations, because all the games now are stored in databases. And I'd like to improve some of these lines. And so I use my creativity to research which lines I want to improve. And the computer gives me suggestions and ideas. But then I still have to learn, well, why did the computer do that? What is the idea? The computer can't explain its move. It just tells you what the best move is. And just like the computer can't tell you really its sources for a lot of the things it says in ChatGPT. And so you don't really know where the ideas came from. You just know the ideas. And you don't know the history of those ideas. So in any case, this is a long way of saying that I think creativity will change and will ultimately get a lot better.
I'm just imagining, I don't know if you or if the listener has messaged me, if we can program the AI to be more mediocre, because let's say I'm an eighth grader and I know that, like, I can't spell good and I don't write well. So I need to train ChatGPT write in an eighth grade language with misspellings and a little bit of neurosis, and then it pop out the perfect page. Have you ever tried to dumb down the AI?
Yeah, and you can do that. I mean, it's possible to do that. So you're saying if someone's cheating using AI.
Yeah, if I was going to cheat, I wouldn't want perfect grammar and words, unleash and uncover and all these words they use all the time that no human uses in writing.
Yeah, so let's. I just had ChatGPT up. let me get it up.
Do you want to share your screen, or is that too much?
Yeah, I'll share my screen.
I'll give you the functions. I've never done this on a podcast before. Guys, check out the show notes. The YouTube link is in the notes if you want to see the screen share and see James's beautiful, beautiful hair.
I'll talk about what I'm doing. So if you don't have YouTube, so I'm basically going to, I got ChatGPT.
You don't have YouTube. My audience has YouTube.
But I don't always.
I'm not going to, no one's going to pull the car over to pull up their YouTube.
Right, right. So I'm sorry. That's what I meant.
No, I know.
And okay, I have ChatGPT up and I'm going to say, write me an essay about, what day is it today?
August 25th. So the listener can tell how long it takes me to produce and release an episode.
Write an essay about the most interesting things that have ever happened on August 25th. Okay, so that's the first thing. So throughout history, August 25th has marked the occurrence of various significant events.
Oh my gosh.
One of the most remarkable events is on August 25th, 1989, when the Voyager 2 spacecraft made its closest approach to Neptune, blah, blah, blah. Okay, so now I'm going to say, write the same essay, but pretend to be, how old are you when you're in eighth grade? You're 14 years old. Pretend to be 14 years old. Dude, like August 25th. Totally
first word was dude.
Yeah, so that's like almost too informal. Yeah. So write the same essay as before, but be a little more formal. Don't use the word dude, for instance. Throughout the annals of history. All right, so we're going to have to... Okay. Now, write the above, but make spelling mistakes at the same rate a 14-year-old would. Like, throughout history, August 25th has seen some... Oh, it's using the word like a lot. Like, big events that totally change things. I'm going to talk about the coolest stuff that happened on this day. I don't see any space. I don't see any misspelling so far.
Yeah.
But
you'd have to go in and add those.
Yeah, but that's okay. Let's see. Write the same, but spell some words incorrectly and don't use the word like. Throughout history, August 25th has seen so many big events that totally changed things. I'm going to talk about the coolest stuff that happened on this day. So back on the day, on August 25th, 1989, there was this super cool thing in space. The Voyager 2 space, but he spelled cool, K-O-O-L. So, you get closer and closer. And then finally, your creativity could take over and say, you know what? I wouldn't say cooler myself, so I'm going to just write that a little.
Let's add one thing.
Uh-huh.
Add a metaphor of a modern celebrity.
Okay. So write the same essay.
But add a metaphor including a modern celebrity. Because I think that's kind of the icing on the cake that'll make it look real, real, real. Yeah.
I'll say pop culture celebrity.
Okay.
In the grand tapestry of history, which doesn't seem like what a 14-year-old would say.
No.
But it does, actually, because it's like overwrought. So let's see. I see. It's almost made the whole thing like metaphorical by making a metaphor to the tapestry of history. So let's try. So by the way, prompt engineering, something where maybe both not used to, has become like an official job for companies. Like we're somehow not writing the exact right prompts. Use a metaphor involving a celebrity. Getting a little annoyed, ChatGPT.
You're also using the free version, it looks like. You're not using ChatGPT-4 in this case.
Oh, maybe.
Yeah, so it writes faster.
Yeah. Yeah, so I don't see it using a metaphor involving a celebrity. So there's probably, maybe I need to upgrade the chat.
Let's try one more thing completely unrelated.
Wait, but I'm just going to say, you didn't use a metaphor of a celebrity. You know what the thing is? It's using with each celebrity, like Jimi Hendrix, but it's using a metaphor. So I'm somehow not quite,
work backwards and give them the celebrity, correct?
Use a metaphor involving a celebrity who has nothing to do with August 25th. It said much like it's using the general.
Yeah.
Okay. So it said much like a celebrity's cameo in an unexpected movie scene, August 25th emerges as a significant date in history featuring a diverse cast. So it's using a metaphor using the word celebrity, but
yeah.
I could mention like a specific celebrity like Kim Kardashian.
Yeah.
But let's see if I say just use a metaphor involving a specific celebrity. I know we're going deep into this, but no, so again, just using the generic celebrity, like August 25th, 1916, embodies a legacy akin to a beloved celebrity's philanthropic endeavors. So it's using like a celebrity dedication to charitable. All right. So clearly we need to work on this, but
yeah,
I think if I did use the word, if I put in like Kim Kardashian, it would figure it out, but we got pretty close to what we wanted to get. And it's almost like an eighth grader's essay.
Yeah.
Just tweak it. And then our eighth graders everywhere can cheat successfully. By the way, I don't even view it as cheating. It's like they used to view calculators as cheating. But now if you like are taking calculus, you know, calculators are used in every test.
It's I've never said this publicly before. This is only behind closed doors, but part of how I did so well in college is I would use 10 to 15, they would ask for 3 sources. It doesn't matter. I would use 10 to 15 sources for everything I wrote because I ended up not writing anything. I would just go through the sources, copy paste the best part. Then I learned how to get ebooks and then I would use the find feature. Then I would look for certain words. And then my paper was just a collection of other people's thoughts. I didn't actually come up with hardly anything new. And then I'd just kind of stumble over a couple of my own thoughts and they'd give me an A.
But you know what? I bet you learn. I mean, the point of education, right, is not to get a good grade. It's to learn. You basically had to read through 10 different sources and then figure out a way to put them together that answered the question, you know, that the essay required. And, you know, you probably learned something.
I didn't act like I had the answer. I just took the answers from people that had written the answer before, and I just became a collection of answers. I just a lot of input data and then put it on the piece of page. When everybody was trying to reinvent the wheel, I was just extracting information that was already done.
My guess is those are the essays you remember better than the essays you wrote yourself from scratch.
Possibly. I don't remember hardly any of them, but
yeah, I get it.
Do you have time for the rapid fire round? I know we kind of went off the rails. I love this. Unshare your screen though, because
oh yeah, sorry.
So the rapid fire round, before we go into the rapid fire round, because I'm cutting this short because we could do another 5 hours, how do we keep in touch with you? Where do you want to send us? What can we do to support you, James?
Well, my most recent book is called Skip the Line. I would recommend that. And it talks about a lot of the things we discussed here, but maybe more in depth. You can find my podcast at The James Altucher Show. I don't really go on social media that much anymore, but I would say those are the main ways to keep in touch.
Yeah, they're in the show notes.
You can always tweet at me. I do look at every now and then who's tweeted at me. So I'm at Jay Altucher on Twitter.
What's a tweet?
You can X me.
That's a question I never even thought to ask you. So, you know, Twitter is now X.com. Isn't that a clear example of not listening to your audience or writing down a bunch of ideas and just taking something that you bought 20 years ago or wherever when you started PayPal and then just shoving it down people's throats? What are your thoughts on X.com? It seems like a selfish move to just Elon has liked X.com when he had X.com before he started PayPal. I feel like it's not, I don't know. What are your thoughts?
Well, it's very interesting you mentioned his experience with PayPal, because not a lot of people know where X.com comes from. So knowing the history of things you're interested in helps you become better at understanding the world around you. So before PayPal, Elon Musk started a digital payments company similar to PayPal called X.com. So there were three payments companies. There was PayPal, X.com, and basically eBay, because eBay was where...
Well, there is Confinity too.
Okay, I didn't even know about Confinity.
It was Confinity. So I had Jimmy Sunny. I'll make an intro if you want, but he wrote the story of PayPal where he went and he interviewed Thiel and Musk and everybody involved in starting it. It was Confinity and X, and then they merged.
Was that the PayPal Wars?
It's called the Founders, the story of PayPal and the faces that shaped Silicon Valley. Everybody wants to talk about the nowadays and open arms. They wanted him to write this book. He was underqualified to do it, but he wrote the entire basically biography on the story of PayPal. It's really cool.
Yeah, no, I think it's really fascinating kind of how digital payments, the history of that. And a lot of people don't know, Elon Musk didn't start PayPal, Peter Thiel did. And Elon Musk had a company, X.com, that was a competitor. But ultimately, Peter Thiel and Elon Musk met and decided they can't both separately compete against eBay. So they merged into PayPal. They didn't use the X.com name. They used the PayPal name. And so Elon's been sitting on that URL forever, X.com. So then you ask, well, why is he using it here? Well, X.com presumably is going to become one of the largest payments platforms on the planet. I mean, it's got a billion users. And my guess is he's going to introduce or allow for some kind of crypto thing happening there. Elon's really into crypto. And so I before it was X.com, I tweeted, I bet you Elon Musk's ultimate goal for Twitter is to make it a large cryptocurrency payments platform. And he actually liked my tweet, and then it was a few weeks later that he changed the name to X.com. So he's moving in that direction. And it starts to give you a sense of, because you know the history of something, it starts to give you a sense of what the future will look like. And since I knew his background, before he even changed the name to X.com, I know his background forever was from the payment side. And that suggested to me that's a direction he's going to take Twitter. And this happens with investing all the time. I watched a video once on YouTube, the five greatest investors ever. And I realized these four guys who were on the video, they were all like CNBC personalities or financial writers, and they knew nothing of the history of investing. Mm. And so I did my own version of it because I studied history very much as I was getting better at investing. And knowing the history of what you're in, the things you're interested in is very valuable. I was talking to some campaign manager who works for one of the presidential campaigns. And he said, you know, this never happened in an election before. And I'm like, well, what about 1996 when Bob Dole ran against Bill Clinton? And he's like, oh man, that's before my time. And I'm like, well, you're a professional in the space. Shouldn't you know, like, an election that was actually fairly recent? Like, I could tell you details about every election this century because I'm fascinated by politics. So, but I at the game of politics, I actually don't care that much about a lot of the issues. But so knowing history is valuable. Like, so you knew more of the history than many people, but that gives you insight into why he did X.com. So he's going to eventually transform what was Twitter into some sort of payments platform.
It's fascinating stuff. To my understanding, he actually bought X.com back from PayPal at some point because they had acquired it, and he paid an exorbitant amount of money to get it back. So he's been sitting on this domain waiting for his next big move for who knows how long, which is very cool.
Yeah. No, when they merged, you know, PayPal owned X.com.
So we're going to, for listener time, we're not going to go through the big, long rapid fire round. I want to ask you just one or two questions. We won't do the full rapid fire, but I'm super curious. Tell us about when you tried to purchase Greenland.
Oh, yeah. So Donald Trump had tweeted, I want to buy Greenland. And the prime minister of Denmark tweeted back, it's not for sale. And this blew my mind. Like, a president of the United States, first off, countries are for sale. You could buy a country. I didn't know that. Then the president of the United States is not like back channeling with his secretary of state. Like, oh, here's a deal we could do for Greenland. He's just tweeting it. He's like making an offer. You know, the United States has the money no matter what it costs. So he's making an offer basically to buy Greenland. Why? Why does he want to buy Greenland? And why and how? And you could do this through a tweet. And then the prime minister of Denmark concluded the negotiation by saying it's not for sale. Well, what does Denmark have to do with this? Like, what do they own Greenland? I thought Greenland was its own country. So I started researching, and it turns out Denmark actually does own Greenland. And then I'm like, well, what's so special about Greenland? And it turns out that Greenland, next to China, is the second largest source of rare earth minerals. So rare earth minerals are these minerals that we use to make semiconductors. You can't have an electric grid without rare earth minerals. And they're rare. They're in China and Greenland and maybe Australia and a few other places. But we get most of our rare earth minerals from China, which is a little, you know, weird. Yeah. And so I started looking at, well, in Greenland, how do they do it? Well, there's a company called Greenland Natural Resources. I forget the exact name. Greenland Rare Earth Company. And I'm like, oh, okay, Greenland's on top of this. And it turns out that company is owned by China. They pay Greenland the mineral rights for all their rare earth minerals. So that's like concerning too. So then I realized, oh, this is actually a national security issue. That's why the president of the United States wants to buy Greenland. And since Denmark gets paid from the payments that China is making to Greenland, Denmark doesn't want to change the situation. And by the way, the people in Greenland, they have no say in this. It's the highest, if you viewed Greenland as a country, which it turns out it isn't because it's owned by Denmark, Greenland has the highest rate of alcoholism of any country. Like, it's sad people living there. And so I said, okay, nobody should own Greenland. So and at the same time, I wanted to do an experiment about writing. Like, most of the time you think of writing as, oh, I'm going to write a blog post, and it's either going to be in first person or second person or third, omniscient third person or whatever. Well, I wanted to experiment with format. So what would it look like to write an article in what I'll call Kickstarter format? So I did that by actually creating a Kickstarter, and then Kickstarter wouldn't allow me, but a GoFundMe to buy Greenland. And so, like, if you know, I gave all the reasons why one would want to buy that I should buy Greenland to make it safe from governments everywhere of the exploiting of their natural resources. And if you donated a certain amount, you would be an earl of Greenland. And if you donate another amount, you could be a duke in Greenland. If you donated a higher amount, you get like 50,000 acres in Greenland. If you donated another amount, you get a holiday named after you. I did a whole GoFundMe and I announced it. And then I basically turned that into an article that I put everywhere, LinkedIn, Facebook, Medium, Huffington Post, whatever. And it started raising thousands of dollars like immediately. And people were tweeting it everywhere and retweeting it and sharing it on Facebook. Like, this guy's crazy. And and then GoFundMe shut me down. I was trying to raise $100 million. And GoFundMe shut me down because they said, listen, we know it's a joke and we're going to have to pay when you return all the money, we're going to have to pay all the cancellation fees to American Express. So they shut it down. But that was me trying to buy Greenland. And it also is a good explanation of, I like to do these little experiments because they're fun little stories too. And I learned something. I learned all about Greenland.
Talk about not saying, taking no for an answer. It's not for sale. I'm going to go try to buy it anyways.
Yeah. Well, I guess Trump took the no, but I didn't.
So my one rapid fire question is, if you actually could, you had the funds, you could buy any country on earth, what country do you want to own?
Greenland.
Still?
Yeah, because it's got trillions of dollars worth of rare earth minerals there. So, and you know, I want to help the people there. Like, they should have a better life. Like, with so much natural resources, they should be a little happier. So they have a high rate of depression over there. Otherwise, I'm not a big buyer of anything for myself. So I don't really have that many belongings.
I'm into that. So to close out, if the listener's wondering, wow, they pulled up ChatGPT, went all over the place. They're wondering, what do I do with this? Give the listener something that we talked about that they can easily integrate into their life. We've talked about so many things that someone could integrate today, but just to give a little bit of homework, what do you recommend someone does so they don't just hear this conversation and go back to normality?
Write 10 ideas a day. Just do that. And they don't have to be good ideas, and they don't have to be business ideas, and they don't have to be ideas for yourself. They could be ideas about someone else. Also, they could be, you know, things you've learned. Like, I watched a speech given the other day by a former presidential candidate. He ran for president in 2012, this guy. And instead of taking notes on the content of his speech, I wrote 10 ideas I was having about his technique of public speaking. Like, this is a guy who's been on the stage running for president. And so I could see the techniques he was using and figuring out some other techniques he seemed to be using. And so I wrote the 10 ways of presidential, my 10 ideas for that day were 10 ways, 10 techniques to use if you're running for president of the United States in a public talk. So it could be just things you're learning. So, but 10 ideas a day, just do that with no expectations. They don't have to be good ideas. You don't have to execute on them. Just assume they're bad. You're just exercising the idea muscle. Just write 10 ideas a day. It should take you 10 to 20 minutes and that's it. And easy, like you said, you'll get 1% better at creativity, which means you'll be in a year 38 times better at creativity than you were a year earlier.
Easy, easy peasy, 10 a day. And so many things we didn't touch on, from the Airbnb to the late night talk show with drunken crazy people. There's all of this is on your podcast, right? The James Altucher Show.
Yeah. Yeah. I talk about a lot of that stuff. So, and I think I'm going to write a book about the nature of a quest. All these things kind of came from quests. So we'll see. I'm still wrestling with this idea of, do I need to achieve my goal to write a book about quests? So I don't know. If anybody out there wants to help me figure this out, tweet me and give me your opinion.
And I'll make sure that's in the notes. I really encourage people. I'm a big fan of James. I'm not just saying this because he's right here. I encourage everybody to go subscribe, to read the books. First one's on me. Message me if you can't afford the book. I'll buy it for you. It's on me. Choose Yourself's great. Reinvent Yourself. Haven't read Skip the Line yet. But what else, man? I know that you say no to a lot of things, and with scheduling concerns and us going long today, we both took a lot out of our day, and I just want to say I'm humbled and I appreciate you taking the time, and you're welcome back anytime.
I appreciate it. I was late also, Ben, the listeners should know I was
they don't need to know that.
Half hour late, and I'm ashamed of it, and I'm sorry, and I appreciate you being cool about it. Thank you.
And I kept you longer, so
fun conversation, unique questions, and I appreciate it very much.